As you've no doubt heard, the Congressional Budget Office is adding to the debate over the Senate health care bill. The CBO estimates uninsured Americans will grow by 22 million people by 2026. Hawaii Public Health Institute Executive Director Jessica Yamauchi says the focus on Medicaid is screening out another important part of what could happen under the Senate bill. The Public Health and Prevention Fund would cease in October. We talked earlier, and she's glad there will not be a vote until after senators come back from the 4th of July holiday.
Yes, the first piece of good news we've gotten.
The other part that may also be construed as good news is that there are Republicans backing away from it because of what we heard from the Congressional Budget Office and the number of people who over a 10-year period would not be able to be insured, according to the way the bill is written now, some 22 million people. The national narrative is continuing, but to look at this from a Hawaii perspective and what it would mean if this bill were to somehow make it through, or certain provisions of it were to make it through, that's what I'd like to talk to you about now. What specifically could happen?
Well, this bill is worse than the House bill for the Prevention and Public Health Fund. It does completely eliminate the fund, which is tied to the Affordable Care Act. The House bill did that as well. But this actually pushes a timeline up to the next fiscal year, which would be October 1 of 2017. And our State Department of Health actually receives a lot of funds from this Prevention and Public Health Fund.
How much do we get?
We get about $17.5 million for the Department of Health. It really impacts our chronic disease prevention and health promotion division. There's several grants that they receive through this funding. And we would really lose critical services in heart disease and stroke prevention, nutrition, physical activity and obesity programs, and tobacco use prevention.
That's a lot of the work that you've been doing over many years, specifically with the tobacco prevention programs.
Yes.
What would that mean in terms of the monies that we've been receiving, say, from the Master Tobacco Settlement, which haven't been going into the education that once were directed to do so? Some of these monies have been picking up some of that, haven't they?
Yes. Yeah, so the tobacco settlement funding supplements what the federal funds give us as well for the tobacco programs. The Prevention and Public Health Fund has really been able to enhance a lot of the services. So with the tobacco prevention funding that we're getting from the prevention dollars, it's really allowed more access and work around priority populations, especially with behavioral health populations. So the funding really has allowed a lot more work in prevention. And I think that that's the piece that's been missing in the local conversation. We really applaud our state legislature for really tackling, trying to put into place some of the pieces of Affordable Care Act that they want to see remain in our state prepaid healthcare law. But what was missing from the dialogue is, what are we going to do if we lose these federal funds, which are really important to the prevention?
Which, if any of this bill were to come through in the way that you have projected it might, would mean that some of these services would be lost.
Yes. There are several staff members that are funded solely through these funds at the Department of Health. There are community grants that have been given out through these funds. Again, it's about $17.5 million that the state receives directly from this funding. We know CDC is looking at a 12% cut, because overall, the State Department gets about $200 million from federal funds. And so if we're going to see, it's not just the elimination of this fund, but we've been noticing in the president's proposed budget that he came out with, you know, cuts across the board. So there's a lot of grave concern, and we're not having the dialogue about how's the state going to help make up the loss of these federal funds.
It's been noted that the president's budget is just the president's budget. Likely it's not going to be the budget that we see come through once we get into the fall. But what are the things that you can see that would be going away, both I'm thinking for behavioral health and for prevention, including for tobacco?
Right. So as I mentioned, you know, this is really focused on a lot of grants received around heart disease and stroke prevention. We actually work with the Department of Health on a specific grant that's funded solely through this prevention fund. And the Hawaii Primary Care Association as well is working on this grant. And it's been a prevention piece and a healthcare piece where the community health centers are integrating diabetes prevention, heart disease prevention, stroke prevention work. And so, you know, I think it's great that the dialogue has really been taken up by our state legislature, and it's important that we talk about what losing Medicaid expansion is going to be and the need, you know, what's going to shift, the burden that's going to shift to the state, and that's all important conversation. We just don't want to lose sight that there's also the prevention piece that would be lost. And as we know, prevention dollars, it's really a return on investment. We need to have prevention in order to really try to help take care of healthcare issues before they are healthcare issues.
Many of our grandmothers would remind us about an ounce of prevention versus a pound of cure.
Yes.
But when we look at behavioral health, too, that really began to get a lot more traction. And if not parity, at least bridging the gap with physical illness under Obamacare, and many who are very, very concerned that that will begin to recede once again if, in fact, this part of it isn't maintained.
Right. I mean, all in all, when we look at, you know, both the House and the Senate health care bills that were proposed, it's really shifting so much of the burden to states to figure out and giving states an opportunity to opt out of certain things because they know that states aren't going to be able to afford things. And it's just making sure that we understand what that whole picture is. And, you know, I don't know how states are going to figure out how to close this gap if at some point one of these bills does pass.
Have you had some conversations with both lawmakers, the governor, to be able to remind that we're going to pay for it one way or the other?
We have been trying to have some of those conversations. You know, there were two bills moving forward in the state legislature this year that really focused on preserving some of the key aspects of Affordable Care Act. When the House bill ended up getting shelved, they ended up turning that into and passing a working group. And the interesting part with the working group is it's being chaired by the Senate and House health chairs. In the Senate, it's Consumer Protection and Health. In the House, it's the health chair. But the vice chairs are also Human Services chairs. And it involves several different departments. But it does not involve Department of Health, which we found interesting.
Was there any reason given why it didn't include the Department of Health?
We don't know. And as far as we know, the conversations we've had with Department of Health, they're not sure why they weren't really invited to the table either. It's, you know, it's the insurance commissioner, it's human services, it's departments of labor and industrial relations, and as needed for information, Department of Budget and Finance and Taxation. But Department of Health is not listed in this working group at all.
Yet it would be one of the auspices that would be losing a great deal of funding if the prevention
Correct.
Fund were to be sliced. An interesting next part of a conversation that I hope you'll be having soon and we'll hear more about.
Great. Thank you.
Jessica Yamauchi is the executive director of the Hawaii Public Health Institute. She hopes more people will understand what will happen if the Public Health and Prevention Fund ends under the Senate health care bill.
Aloha, I'm Christy Martin from the Coordinating Group on Alien Pest Species. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Well, I can listen to everything I need for the day, from the news to the music to good stories, and it's 24/7, 365. I think probably Derek in his morning edition is one of my favorites, and of course I love Kanakapila on Sunday afternoons.
Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, learning to speak with confidence in the company of folks who are just as scared as you are. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking back to the early days of the city of Honolulu. A city and county government system for Honolulu had been created by the Organic Act of 1900, but the ruling oligarchy was in no hurry to dilute its power. It took until 1907 for an election to be held for the office of Honolulu mayor. It was described as a colorful contest, with election rallies that featured hula dancers and plenty of music. Voter turnout was high. A Democrat defeated Republican John C. Lane for the office, becoming Honolulu's first mayor. It's his name we're looking for this morning. He won by only 7 votes, and the advertiser prematurely reported his opponent as the victor. Can you tell us the first mayor's name? Call us if you know, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're first and right, you'll get the prize.
Support for The Conversation comes from Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui and Honolulu Waldorf School on Oahu, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school, now accepting applications at both schools.
It's never easy to overcome fear, but it can be done if you do it in the company of people who've been through the same struggle. That's the way Toastmasters addresses the fear that's routinely listed as among our worst, the all-too-familiar dread of speaking in public. Stanley Ewan is a Toastmasters member who can attest to its benefits. He and the organization are wondering if there are more people out there who can benefit from their methods, and Stanley is with us in our studio. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Chris.
I guess the way to start is to sort of look at where you were before you joined this organization, how you felt about speaking in public.
That's a good question. About 9 years ago, I guess I was a lot younger then, and I had heard from some friends about a group called Toastmasters I decided to visit. And one of the things that we do in Toastmasters is not only do we practice prepared speeches, we do impromptu speeches, mm-hmm. and you're supposed to respond to a question that you've never heard before for 1 or 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I had barely made 40 seconds before I had to get off the stage.
Really?
They somehow were able to invite me back, and that was the rough beginning of my Toastmasters mm-hmm. journey.
But there was what was it that made you want to get off the stage? Just flat-out terror of the situation?
I feel every time that I go in front of people a little bit of nervousness. I don't know how people feel it, whether it's, you know, a tightness in the chest area
mm-hmm.
or you feel your heart beating really fast. I felt a lot of those at that time, and
mm-hmm.
I still feel it today. One of the advantages of having gone through Toastmasters is when I feel it, I don't necessarily identify it with fear. Or I can identify it with excitement, or I simply identify it with that's what's going to happen every single time I go up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I deal with it.
It's energy in some kind of form.
Exactly.
It's kind of a little bit depends on the attitude you want to have toward the energy, I would think.
That's pretty much what it is.
So a person with this very common terror that is often listed as among our worst fears, you know, much far more than, you know, we're more afraid of public speaking than we are of grizzly bears, and which doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you think about it. But that's been true of a lot of people, hasn't it?
I believe it makes a lot of sense. I hear it said that people would rather be the guy in the coffin than the guy telling the eulogy. You know, they're so afraid of it. Uh-huh. And when it comes to fear back in the day was about survival, but it's also about survival of ego and survival of self. So when we're afraid of damaging our image, or mm-hmm. you know, we're afraid of people laughing at us, these are things that are protecting us. So our fear protects us, but it doesn't always protect us in significant ways. Sometimes it prevents us from being able to do really great things. And so fear of public speaking, fear of putting my image, you know, putting my self-worth on the line, that's one of the fears that we have, not in just our society. Toastmasters is an international organization.
Yeah.
And so it's a fear that's common in many cultures, possibly all cultures.
Well, let's say you get up in a public speaking situation and just bomb. I mean, it's a disaster. You know, there's nothing you can't save that particular day. Can that be used to your benefit? You know, that can that experience become a salutary one?
I think all of us, if we've lived long enough, have made some mistakes in our life, and yes. we always know that mistakes are useful lessons for mm-hmm. us. And as long as we see it that way, we're willing to make more mistakes. One of the great things about Toastmasters is that it's in the form of many different clubs. There's over 60 clubs in the state of Hawaii alone.
Wow.
And each one of them is filled with people, like you said at the beginning, who are just as afraid as I am. Mm-hmm. And so we're willing to support each other, get through that. And it's a practice session with a live audience, mm-hmm. which is much more significant than a practice session in front of a mirror.
Sure.
If we are able to do that in front of a live audience and we feel much better about it, and we can talk about whatever we want in these settings too. Some people use it as practice for their professional setting. Some people for specific things like, oh, I have to do the speech as the best man for my friend's wedding.
Right.
Or simply as practice for generally communicating, because the communication skills that we build in the meantime, we can use in all sorts of situations.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that people in the performing arts say all the time to comfort themselves and to comfort our fellow performers is that audiences want you to succeed. Nobody pays $20 to go sit in a seat and have a terrible time, right? They want the show to be good. They want you, the performer, to do well. Does that apply to public speaking situations as well?
I think the thought is nice, and it's important to have optimism when you step onto the stage. The reality, being a member of the audience, is that you could be in all sorts of situations. You could be looking at your phone. You could be worrying about your day. You could be really focused on the person. You could have maybe a bone to pick with the person who happens to have a mustache, and so you don't like people with mustaches because of some past incident. You don't know what's going on in their mind.
So you can't really you shouldn't rely on that, is what you're saying.
I believe that as a speaker, really, you should be confident, and if you have to tell yourself, hey, these people are here for me and they want me to succeed, then absolutely, that's what you're going to create. What you believe in your mind ultimately is what you create. It's mm-hmm. ultimately what you communicate. That's mm-hmm. what I believe. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of people who learn that through Toastmasters. Toastmasters helps you develop a lot of the really fundamental skills of communication, which in the end is about me being honest with myself and then communicating with you, us having a true connection, mm-hmm. whether it's one-on-one or whether it's with an audience.
This sounds like a little bit more than a public speaking lesson.
That's what it became for me.
It sounds like a life lesson, right?
Yeah. You know, that's really why Toastmasters, I feel, is so successful, because we start with a lot of the fundamentals. How we build our speeches, how we control our voice, how we do all these little things. All the technical stuff. Mm-hmm. And we believe that these are the fundamentals, but they all pull us back to the real fundamental, which is how do we communicate, how do we interrelate with one another mm-hmm. as human beings?
Well, you know, somebody once told me that the way to appear interested in an interview situation was to be interested. Mm-hmm. Right? There is no substitute for that, you know, in any kind of human interaction. And it's, in a way, you can't fake it. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the best ways I feel is, you know, it's both about what's inside and what's outside. And if you want to change what's inside, sometimes you have to do something outside. So I'm just going to throw out a quick plug and say, look up Toastmasters in Hawaii and go visit a club. We always love guests. And, you know, if you see something that you like, you're welcome to ask anybody in the club questions and possibly join and, you know,
well, you know, Stanley,
see what it does for you.
I was thinking about that thing you said earlier about being prepared to answer a question you'd never heard before. So let's say would you get called on in a Toastmasters session or, you know, do you get things sprung on you? Do you have to be ready for that?
Both situations. One, you can volunteer. If there are no volunteers, then you'd get called on. That's the usual way I see things run. Mm-hmm. But after a while, you get comfortable, maybe you get excited, you'll see more volunteers in a club.
Pretty soon, you're sticking your hand up and wanting to speak then.
Exactly.
That's great. Stanley, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Stanley Yuen is a member of the Hawaii Kai chapter of Toastmasters International, and you can learn more about the organization on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Handcrafted Restaurants, celebrating the craft of food, drink, and merrymaking at Monkey Pod Kitchen by Merriman in Ko'olina, Oahu, and Wailea, Maui, and at Moku Kitchen, now open in Kaka'ako.
Next time on Ask Me Another, actor Betty Gilpin gets in the ring and chats about her new Netflix series, Glow, created by the team behind Orange is the New Black. It's a comedy based on the gorgeous ladies of wrestling, a real-life all-women wrestling league founded in the 80s. So limber up and join me, Ophira Eisenberg, for NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Saturday at noon, following Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Projects that promote transit-enhanced neighborhoods can get special permits for higher and denser development. But are developers getting a sweet deal at the expense of workers who need housing they can afford? CivilBeat.org reporter Stuart Yurton has today's reality check. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Beth Ann.
Okay, so this idea of transit-oriented development that we've been talking about for such a long time was, you know, put out there to create more affordable housing around transit, you know, workforce housing, senior housing, all around rail. Now, it seems that's not exactly happening with some of these special permits. What kind of projects are getting them?
So we've seen three down near the Alawana Center Terminal, or the site of the rail terminal there at the end of the line so far. One that was approved is a condo hotel down at the corner of Atkinson and Kapi'olani across from the Hawaii Convention Center. So that's one hotel. There's another one that is behind Walmart on Sheridan Street. That one is a condo, luxury condo project. That one has stalled for a while. And the one that's going before the Department of Planning and Permitting today is another hotel. This is a full-service hotel with about 444 rooms. It's a really big project.
I've heard you say the word hotel a couple of times, the word condo a couple of times, luxury at least once. Doesn't exactly sound like some of this transit-oriented development that would be enhancing neighborhoods in the way that we've sort of been talking about for a while. How can this be happening?
Well, part of the problem or part of the issue is that the ordinance is a little vague on some of these things. The ordinance talks about things like creative catalytic redevelopment, and it talks about projects that will create a sort of mix of jobs and employment opportunities, support intermodal transportation or sort of rail transportation, talks about a mix of housing, talks about public space, and other things that I think we can kind of envision as being a lot different from a hotel. But the ordinance which guides this, does this development doesn't really say a project has to have X, Y, and Z. It gives the Department of Planning and Permitting and ultimately the City Council discretion to kind of ultimately say, yeah, this meets our idea of transit-oriented development.
Okay, so that language, though, creative, catalytic, it sounds a little nebulous and certainly gives developers a lot of latitude. How can then we be sure that there's going to be some place for people who need affordable housing, rentals, all of that, seniors especially? How do we ensure that there will be a place for them?
Well, that's a really good question. There is one bill that Councilman Brandon Elefante has proposed, and it's making its way through the council right now. The bill is Bill 15, CD1, and it would rein in some of this activity and create a affordable housing requirement for these projects that are getting the special sort of it's a special permit that the transit-oriented development projects get. So this bill would require developers to set aside a certain amount of their project for affordable housing on site, and it would require it. It's not nebulous.
Okay, so how about the idea, though, that we've heard floated too, well, what about trading off space? If this is going to be given certain waivers to get higher and denser and is more maybe luxury or is certainly midline and up, how about being able to trade off some space to be able to create places for people who are in the lower economic echelon?
Well, that's kind of the idea now. So just to back up one moment, the ordinance as it's written basically says we're going to have a deal. If you're a developer and you want to come in and develop something, we'll waive limits on height, density, other things that make it hard for you to build what you want to build, but we want things that will help help fulfill this vision. One of the things the developer can do is provide community benefits. Community benefits can include affordable housing. So the affordable housing can become part of the deal between the city, which is giving a green light to these projects that otherwise couldn't be developed, and the developer, which is sort of getting this special benefit. So that's kind of what happens and what's happening. And those are the discussions that are going on now. This particular project would have 68 units. This is on Kapi'olani near Keamoku Street, and it's the units would be above the Walgreens parking lot.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens both with the bill in the City Council and also with some of these developments. Thanks very much for the story.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org. Today we spoke with Stuart Yurton.
I saw waves lift in the sea, waving at you, but they don't see me.
The EPA is changing its approach to how beach water quality will be tested under the Clean Water Act. In Hawaii, the Department of Health is responsible for monitoring the quality of beach water, and with the coming changes, the DOH is asking for public comment. The deadline for the comment period was recently extended to September 1st. This morning, Stuart Yamada, chief of the DOH Environmental Management Division, met me in our studio to talk about the difference of the EPA approach that the public is being asked to consider.
Well, basically, the Department of Health used to focus solely on, I should say, human sewage events and posting of signs when there was either evidence by testing or knowledge of spills in nearshore coastal waters, and that would cause a posting. With the change in approach, basically, we're going solely based on our water quality monitoring. Whenever enteral cocci level of bacteria exceeds the action level of 130, it's required to post and notify the public on our website.
Is that different for Hawaii, being that we're in a tropical environment, than, say, if we were in California?
Well, it is in a sense that Enterococcus, even though it's the national standard, it is not an ideal organism for Hawaii because it's ubiquitous. It exists throughout the environment. It can come from humans. It could come from animals. It can come from decaying vegetation, soil in the sand. So, yeah, it loses kind of its luster because on the continent, Enterococcus is primarily an indicator for human sewage. But in the tropics, it's not that well defined. It could be from almost anything.
So how much sense does this new approach make for Hawaii if, in fact, we're going to find Enterococcus everywhere?
Well, you know, there is some debate about that, but I think what the EPA felt very strongly about, and a lot of environmentalists, is that as long as we're collecting this kind of bacterial data, we should be sharing it. So what we're trying to do is that we're getting into a habit of always posting and notifying people, but at the same token, we are also trying to expand an educational effort to help people understand, because there will be a time when the Enterococcus levels are really high and there is a concern that it could still make someone sick, even though it may not be human-related.
Does that argue for a different standard for Hawaii?
There has been a lot of interest in creating a different standard, and what a surprise. Under federal laws, you can, but it's basically moving mountains. I think the state of California has been looking into that to change from Enterococci, but to date, they still have not been able to gather enough data to convince the federal government.
So where does this leave Hawaii as people are being asked to comment on these changes and to make suggestions about how water quality should be tested?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of room for how we can go about doing business, and especially, you know, the language and the notifications, how we notify people, and even, you know, looking towards the future, who helps collect the data for us. There's serious consideration being given to the expanding of adopting third-party data.
We talked with Stuart Coleman from the Surfrider Foundation when Kauai's waters were being tested and as Oahu's beaches were beginning to be tested, the water around the beach. And he was making the point that maybe there might be some room there for collaboration. Is that being talked about?
Yes. You know, I think what we're looking at right now is the base, the complying outright with the federal requirements of the Beach Act. And then from there, it will evolve because I think we're all, unfortunately, looking forward to ultimate federal cuts. And we know we will never have all the resources we could possibly need. And it requires us to embrace and engage with others, especially with the surf riders and groups like them.
So are there ongoing conversations happening now in preparation? Because if you say you're anticipating these cuts, and clearly we're seeing changes in the way the EPA is being run and what impact that may have on Hawaii, isn't it good to be able to create something that is already in play once those cuts may happen?
You know, there have been preliminary discussions, but because right now the focus is on attaining EPA compliance, because we still have the grant and it will probably at least continue through next year. So there is time to start preparing. But yes, we are engaging in conversation because it's very important. I think, you know, a lot of people realize that the Department of Health is a conduit for which information can be posted and circulated. And that's very important. And in the same token, it's very important that the data be reliable. And I think all parties involved realize this, that there's a extreme importance to be accurate, and because we all lose credibility if we post junk data. But I think the future is very promising for the involvement of third parties.
One party we haven't yet talked about is tourism. When the prospect of having signs posted that might be warning people off beaches could come to, you know, fruition, that might be a scary thing for the tourism industry. How have they been responding?
You know, to their credit, they've been extremely responsive and embraced the whole project. They agree with us that this is all about protecting their guests. so that they can have the most enjoyable experience. I mean, it's not a very enjoyable experience to be sick on your vacation. So if they can help alleviate that, warn them off of times when the water quality is poor or from areas where water quality is generally poor, so where stream mouths, storm drains enter the beach, those will always be problematic. And so they were very instrumental in us in developing of a simple brochure to help illustrate these very simple things. So that's, you know, beyond the monitoring, this is really about public education because there are consistencies in where we often see high bacterial levels. And if we can inform and instruct both residents and tourists, I think we'll be well ahead of the game.
In part of helping people to be informed, you're also asking for public input. Now that deadline has been extended to September 1, there's also the idea that, well, you may get all this input by that point, but will there actually be any funds by the time we get to that point to do anything about the issues that people are concerned with?
You know, there is a very real concern. You know, we try not to get too bogged down in that, but it's clear to us, Department of Health, not just in environmental, but other preventative health aspects, that we are looking at cuts in the very near future. And, you know, we try to be cognizant of that. And I think it's like what you brought up before, it's going to require us to engage with others, to embrace a bigger cadre of resources, more than what the state can possibly handle. And I think, you know, in that regard, the future is bright. And that's why a lot of the comments that we're getting, you're correct. They're talking about expansion of the program when we're looking at potential severe reduction, if not deletion, of federal funding. But still, I think there's a lot of good points that our people are bringing up. And, you know, it's important that we get that kind of input. It's been years since we've engaged with the public on this subject area.
That also seems to argue for a coalition, not just a third-party investment in all of this. Has there been any thought to being able to network several organizations together or to be able to broaden that conversation so you might be able to tackle more?
You know, I think there already is, because there's a group on Maui that's already been recognized for their work that they're doing for water quality testing. And they've also engaged with us and with Surfrider. Surfrider covers all the major islands, so that's really good. And we've also engaged with I can't remember the exact organization, but there's a beach website that's largely put up by Water Safety of the city and county and all the counties in the state. And to their credit, they've also embraced our messaging because they realize that beach safety is more than just bad tides or currents or rough ocean waters. They recognize, too, that water quality plays a part in this in terms of advising the general public. So, you know, yeah, you talk about coalition. I think we are definitely moving to that, and we're embracing, and we are in return being embraced by others to engage.
That sounds like some good news. Stuart Yamada, thank you so much.
Thank you, Beth.
Stuart Yamada is the chief of the Department of Health's Environmental Management Division. If you'd like more information about how you can submit your comments, see our Facebook page, The Conversation.
When I knew that I'd become the ocean's slave, I just stayed. And we carried forward all the waters past. Of the waves, I was not first, I was not last. And if we saw a boat afloat, we took the mast so fast.
Aloha, I'm Claire Hannis, an immigration attorney, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you about Honolulu's first mayor, who took office in 1908. He was born in Kohala on Hawaii Island in 1872 and had limited education. His rustic ways were widely mocked by the oligarchy-owned newspapers of the day, but he managed to defeat his Republican opponent by 7 votes in an election in 1907. He was remembered as a gifted campaigner who was able to reach out to audiences in Hawaiian, Japanese, Chinese, Portuguese, and English at his campaign rallies. As mayor, he's remembered for creating a template of city government and emphasizing the importance of land acquisition for parks and playgrounds. He served as mayor until 1919, and Fern Elementary School and Playground are named in his honor. That's the name we were looking for this morning, Joseph James Fern. And that's today's quiz. Nobody got that today. But if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, wishing all students, parents, teachers, and administrators an enjoyable summer, providing opportunities for student summer reading with Achieve Hawaii Home Access. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
This isn't love. There's no guacamole. If this isn't love, I'm Zsa Zsa Gabor. Dream, and if I should wake up.
The 1947 Broadway musical Finian's Rainbow was ahead of its time in many ways. While it delivered the standard musical comedy tropes of a sweet romance and silly subplots, it had some bite to it, using humor to attack the racism that was all too prevalent in those post-war years. The combination probably wouldn't work without plenty of comedy and some great songs, but it does, and the show has stayed relevant and continued to find new audiences down through the years. Director Susie Bond is bringing the show to the Kilauea Drama and Entertainment Network's Kilauea Theater on Hawaii Island next week, and she's on the line to tell us about the production. Hi, Susie.
Hi, Chris. How's it going?
Great, great. What drew you to this show?
Well, we did the show when I was working with the Art Center 18 years ago, and it's just so much fun, and it just has such a relevant theme, especially these days, that it was time to bring it back.
Well, I mean, the plot includes what, a leprechaun, magic, and a southern senator who was based on kind of a notorious character of the time.
Yeah, and is kind of notorious these days, too.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing how relevant that whole part of the show is, the racial issues and the corrupt politician issues.
Well, describe for me, if you would, a little bit how that fits into the story.
Well, there's the senator is trying to buy up all the land in the valley to prevent them from bringing electricity in, because it's going to be the ruination of the valley,
mm-hmm.
of Rainbow Valley in Mississauga.
Mm-hmm.
And but there's one piece of land he can't is having trouble acquiring, and that's the one that belongs to Woody Mahoney and his sister Susan. And Finian and his daughter pay the interest on the taxes that are owed, and so Finian asks him for a little piece of it, and that's where he buries his pot of gold that mm-hmm. he has stolen from the leprechauns in Ireland.
Mm-hmm. And the leprechauns aren't at all pleased about that, as I recall.
Oh, no, no. Og is sent over to try and get the croc back from him, and as Finian has control of it, the leprechauns are becoming more and more mortal.
Mm-hmm.
And so Og's dilemma is that he's becoming more mortal, but in the process he's also discovering things like love, and is falling in love with the girl he's near.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's just such a wonderfully fun plot, you know. I mean, that all of the silly plot twists are just so much fun.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it has one of my favorite, every musical of this type has got their sort of falling in love, the guy and the girl scene, right?
Right.
And with you leading to the song. And in this case, it's that old Devil Moon, yeah?
Yes.
I love that scene.
I do, too. And Kaimi Moraes and Samantha Psyche are wonderful. Woody and Sharon just are so adorable when they're singing it. It's just, you have to smile.
Well, it reminds me of the scene in Oklahoma, If I Loved You, where the guy and the girl very kind of shyly declare their feelings. Yeah?
Right, right.
It adds a kind of a tenderness to it.
It does. It adds a lot of tenderness to it. But I'll tell you, Samantha will knock your socks off with How Are Things in Guacamora.
Yeah.
She just, the first time she sang it in rehearsal, I just started to cry. And so did the accompanist. it's such a wonderful song, and it is sort of a little tearjerker, and it's right at the beginning of the show. It's sort of like, hey, we're going to have a happy song, and then we're going to whack you in the face, and then we're going to have another happy song right after that. So it's, but it's you know, once again, we're having a lot of fun. We've got a lot of families involved for the first time ever. We've got three generations of one family in a show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of fun for us, a dad, his son, and granddaughter. And the dad is one of the gospeliers, the son is playing Rockins, and the granddaughter is playing Diana, one of the kids in the show.
The gospeliers, where are they in the show?
They come in after Senator Rockins has been wished black by Sharon, who was standing by the crock, and unknowingly, she's angry with him about the way he's treating the people in the town. So she says, I wish you were black, and turns him black. And he wanders around out in the forest for a couple of weeks, and the gospeliers come along, and they've lost one of their members. And Rockins is, when he, Og puts a spell on him to make him a nicer person.
Uh-huh.
And so he wakes up singing, and the gospeliers come along and say, hey, we need a fourth. And so it's the first time he's been accepted as the person that he is, which is now the black man.
Uh-huh.
And but then he finds out that he has no rights as a black man, unless he has to be to go back to white to have any rights.
You know, Susie,
it's that whole thing of the racial issue coming back and forth. And sadly, themes are very true.
Sure.
So,
Susie, when I saw a Broadway revival of that show, that moment, the transformation moment, it stopped the show. I mean, it was brilliant.
They did theirs with a mask, didn't they, in the revival?
No.
Or did they actually switch actors?
They switched actors. And
yeah, we didn't have someone who was 6'4" and matched the guy that we got. We have to deal with it in a little bit different way. People have been saying, well, what are you going to do, have him go blackface? And it's like, no, because we're not going to go to that insensitive point.
Yeah.
But we are going to darken his skin tone.
Well, you know, it's amazing to me whenever I think about the show that you can have what's basically a fun and frothy Broadway musical with that kind of a message in it and have that message actually work.
Right. And it does work in this show. The whole theme is brought at you, and yet it's resolved nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point is that we are a rainbow. There's a rainbow of faces and cultures. And one of the things I like about doing it here is that there really is a rainbow. It's not just about black and white, and we do have our racial issues here in the islands.
Mm-hmm.
And, being a Holly girl born in a plantation town on Maui, I've got the other side of that. It's not to the extent that it is in the South by any stretch of the imagination, but there is that whole racial thing, and it's nice to bring together that rainbow of culture and create something positive out of it.
I quite agree, Susie. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for supporting KDEN. We really appreciate it.
Well, have a great show. Susie Bond is the director of the Kilauea Drama and Entertainment Network, known as KDEN's production of Finian's Rainbow, its 15th annual summer musical. The show will run July 7th through 23rd, with performances on Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30, Sundays at 2:30 p.m. at KMC's Kilauea Theater.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and our Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama joins us to look at events going on under the radar. And you know, Derek, I just heard steel guitar on that.
Yes.
Little bit of intro music. Is there any connection?
Quite a segue, right. You read my mind.
Wow.
Yeah. You can learn about the history of Hawaiian steel guitar tomorrow on Maui. You can join Valley Isle musician and instructor Joel Katz for an evening of Hawaiian steel guitar music. But I believe you heard Jerry Bird,
yeah.
Right? Who is playing.
The great Jerry Bird.
Yes, the great Jerry Bird. You can learn how this technique originated in Hawaii in the late 1800s, and how the steel guitar and playing style has evolved over the years. Yeah.
Well, let's hope we generate lots more steel guitar players.
Oh, definitely. Right? This free program is suitable for all ages, and it's in the Wailuku Public Library at 6:30 tomorrow.
And the family gets to see a free movie tomorrow on Oahu.
This is happening at Waimea Valley. It's part of their Screen on the Green series. Tomorrow's free film is Ghostbusters. This is the one from last year with Melissa McCarthy. Mm-hmm. There's a farmer's market first from 2 to 6 p.m. The movie starts at 7:15 on the main lawn. So bring a beach blanket or a low chair to see it.
All the ingredients of a day at the on the North Shore.
And
learn about coral health in Hawaiian waters in a talk in Hilo on Friday.
Dr. John Burns of UH Manoa will discuss the impacts of disease and climate change on coral populations. And also you can see a screening of Reefs at Risk. This documentary talks about the impacts of oxybenzone on Hawaii's coral reefs. The lecture and the film take place at 6:30 Friday night in Hilo's Aupuni Center. And that's Conference Room 101. This is on Friday.
Well, thanks as always, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
And in just a couple of minutes, we'll be at the top of the hour, and it's time for us to say aloha for today. It's the end of an era and the beginning of the next of the Hawaii Community Foundation. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the transition from the leadership of Kelvin Takeda to Mike Akane. Both will join me for Town Square.
And we'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. Email is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
We've gotten a couple of emails asking how to listen back to part of the show or find other parts to other shows. Just look under The Conversation on our on HawaiiPublicRadio.org, and you'll find it right there. Just look under Talk Shows. You'll find The Conversation.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow for Town Square.
Sisters